This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
President Trump steps back from the Iran deal and gets ready to step up sanctions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 8th of May. Good to have you with us. And we are going to start with an economic look at President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear agreement. The deal was struck 3 years ago with China, France, Germany, Russia, and the U.K. Iran agreed to several things, including limiting its enrichment of uranium and reducing its stockpiles, and allowing international monitors. In exchange, decades of international sanctions were lifted. Now, President Trump says, no more.
We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States.
We know that in the year after the deal went into place, Iran's real GDP grew by 12.5%. Growth has certainly fallen off since then, and there were protests in Iran this winter over economic inequality. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson joins me now for a financial look at what leaving the deal means. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Lizzie.
What do we know about what the new sanctions will look like?
So the new sanctions will look a lot like the old sanctions. The way this deal worked was it gave Iran lots of sanctions relief. It didn't lift all sanctions, but it lifted lots of them. So Iran could sell as much oil as it wanted. Foreign banks were allowed to do business with the country. As you mentioned, this was a really big deal for the Iranian economy, but it certainly wasn't a cure-all. So the logistics of sanctions relief in the U.S. were that every few months, the president had to re-waive the sanctions lifted by this deal. This weekend, waivers that allowed Iran to sell oil sanction-free, those were set to expire. The president isn't just reimposing those sanctions, however. He's reimposing all previous sanctions, even the ones that weren't supposed to expire this weekend, across lots of sectors, targeted country companies, people, everything from Iranian carpets to shipping is affected.
Well, what does this mean for U.S. companies doing business in Iran?
So as of today, no new business can be done with Iran. Firms with existing contracts, they have a wind-down period, 90 or 180 days, where they have to wrap up their deals. Some companies have probably been anticipating this. Trump's been talking a lot about pulling out of this deal as far back as the campaign, especially recently. So Boeing, for example. Boeing has a deal to sell a bunch of planes to an Iranian airline. It said recently it's not banking on those deals going through as it plans its upcoming production.
We talked about how this was a big deal. What about, say, German companies, Chinese companies? What happens to them and their access to Iranian markets?
So we don't entirely know how U.S. allies are going to react here. Leaders in Germany and France and the U.K., they've been pressuring President Trump to stay in this deal, and perhaps they'll try and continue on without the U.S. But even if those countries don't reimpose their own sanctions, foreign firms are going to have a really tough time operating in Iran if they also want to interact with the U.S. financial system. That gives the U.S. lots of power here. I talked about this with Cliff Kupchan. He's chairman of the Eurasia Group and a longtime expert on Iran.
The countries can make political agreements. They can agree to compensate companies that are hurt by U.S. sanctions. They can make observance of U.S. sanctions illegal. But the market's going to make these decisions, not politicians and not laws.
And he thinks for firms in countries like the EU, Japan, South Korea, CEOs and boards of directors aren't going to want to risk losing access to the U.S. financial system, so they'll comply. Other countries, maybe not so much.
I think the Russians and the Chinese will very likely ignore sanctions. And I think there's a reasonably good chance that the Indians and the Turks will do the same.
So Kupchan says there are ways that banks or companies can set themselves up so they don't depend on access to the U.S. financial system. They can sort of operate outside the reach of sanctions. So if there's winners in today's announcement, it's those firms in, say, Russia or China that will operate in Iran despite the sanctions. Because, yes, Iran's economy is going to be really hurt by these sanctions, but there's still a lot of potential there.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
On Wall Street today, it's actually pretty flat despite all this. Details when we do the numbers. Today, the Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, stepped down. He was accused of physical abuse against four women in the New Yorker magazine and resigned just hours after the story broke. Schneiderman had made a name for himself as a crusading progressive, going after fraud on Wall Street and corporate America in general, from Volkswagen to ExxonMobil, even branding himself as an ally of Me Too and suing Harvey Weinstein. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Eric Schneiderman went after Bank of America Merrill Lynch for misleading investors, BlackRock for insider trading, and Barclays Capital for securities violations. He was third in a line of aggressive Wall Street enforcers in the attorney general chair, starting with Elliot Spitzer and then Andrew Cuomo. New York antitrust lawyer Lloyd Constantine.
Spitzer took it to a level where he was de facto the most important enforcer in the country, actually superseding the federal regulators at the time. And Schneiderman continued that practice.
Schneiderman had two big tools, broad jurisdiction over banks and companies listed on Wall Street, and a strong anti-fraud law that doesn't require proof of fraud or intent to subpoena company documents. He didn't just go after banks. Also Volkswagen, Trump University, ExxonMobil, sports betting sites. But here's the thing about his cases.
Very few of them were litigated.
Columbia law professor John Coffey.
Almost invariably. Publicly held firms do not want the publicity of a trial and some notoriety. They settle, and they settle often at significant amounts of money.
To his enemies in corporate America, Schneiderman wielded a big legal stick to prosecute, extract money, and showboat. James Fanto teaches at Brooklyn Law School.
I'm sure there will be some celebration by people who've been targeted by him. And you know, sometimes people feel that they've been unfairly targeted.
The question is whether anything changes under the next New York Attorney General. Fanto says it's traditionally been an office for aggressive oversight. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Of all the changes to our economy in the past decade, one of the biggest is the rise of the sharing economy. And that, of course, includes Airbnb. But new research in San Francisco finds that Asian and Hispanic hosts tend to charge less for their rentals than their white counterparts, which means they are missing out on potential income. Venu Kakar is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University, and she did the research with a team of students. Welcome.
Very happy to be here.
So you took a look at what people are willing to charge for an Airbnb property in San Francisco. What did you find?
Asian and Hispanic Airbnb hosts charge 8 to 10% lower than their white counterparts.
Do you know why?
There might be that Hispanic or Asian hosts are experiencing a lower demand because now this online marketplace has become very susceptible to traditional market failures. And even though you have an equivalent rental to your white counterpart, they go and rent from the white host. But this is not the only explanation. It's possible that there is reverse discrimination going on. A minority host might be pricing lower to attract a bigger pool of potential renters to choose from, etc.
I wonder what role, if any, housing segregation played in this, because I'm curious, you know, we know from looking at city data in so many places that housing can be tremendously segregated. Often an area that is predominantly white can have certain home values. Areas with more people of color can have other home values. Did that play into this?
because this is primarily short-term, these are short-term rentals in Airbnb, we don't really observe that. However, we do control for the percentage of whites, Asian, and Hispanics in each neighborhood. We obviously do find that the areas that are predominantly white are priced higher.
So thinking about this going forward and trying to, you know, as you talk about it, correct a market failure, is that possible? And, you know, how would that even be done? I mean, I guess, would you have to remove all personally identifying information out of a peer-to-peer marketplace in order to do that?
That's a good question. And that's a difficult question to ask as well, because Airbnb is not forcing hosts to put this information out there. But one thing that could be done is to make the biographical information less prominent on the Airbnb. When a potential renter goes there, it's sort of not all in your face that you're seeing the race of the host and all of their biographical information. Maybe they can make user reviews more prominent.
Well, let me push you on one thing. You are looking at the supply side of this chain here, and ultimately it is the hosts who set the price.
Correct.
So how much of that can we say definitively is chalked up to discrimination?
Well, we do rule out the possibility that they are not pricing lower because of increasing their occupancy or maximizing their occupancy rates. They're not doing that because we do control for occupancy rates. So we can rule that out. And then we are left with really, is there a social objective out there that minority hosts are trying to accomplish? Or is there reverse discrimination going on? These are some of the other explanations that we can offer. The study that is very similar to ours and actually got released before us does indicate that there is possibility of racial discrimination among Black and non-Black hosts in New York City. However, they don't entertain some of these other explanations that we are providing.
Venu Kakkar is an assistant professor of economics at San Francisco State University. Thanks so much for talking with us about your work.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We reached out to Airbnb, and they told us every Airbnb host sets their own price and has access to smart pricing tools that provide dynamic feedback based on their unique space without any regard or consideration for host identity. Coming up.
Wow, that's a lot different than before when you were going to Capitol Hill and interviewing senators and congressmen and traveling around the world.
That moment, you know, you're in a different chapter of your life. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained a tiny fraction, 2 points, to close at 24,360. The NASDAQ gained less than 0.1%, 1 point, to finish at 7,266. And the S&P 500 shed a fraction, ending at 2,671. Oil prices were volatile today ahead of the news that the U.S. is withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. Crude oil closed at $69, off 1.4%. BP fell 1.3%. ExxonMobil pumped up 0.4%. Chevron clicked up 1.3%. Cable giant Comcast is shoring up its financial armor in its quest to take over 20th Century Fox, according to published reports. Fox agreed in December to sell some of its entertainment assets to Walt Disney for more than $52 billion in stock. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Since the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, that killed 17 people, there's been a lot of talk about how to prevent more tragedies. Much of that discussion has been about guns. But there's another dimension to this issue, demand for a whole range of products and services to make schools safer from gun violence. From the Marketplace Hub at the IdeaStream newsroom in Cleveland, Adrian Mahl reports.
You don't just walk into a Norton, Ohio public school. There's a protocol. Before you enter the middle school, for instance, Superintendent Dana Addis demonstrates how visitors go through what's called a secured vestibule. Basically, a glass and metal box with one way in, one way out.
So, any of our visitors that come in, they have to press a button.
A camera lets a staff member see who's there, And if everything looks okay, they release the locks.
And then you hear the click, so that opens the door.
Until recently, Addis says most of his schools had a vestibule like this, except one, the elementary school. He says the school board was waiting until summer break to add one, but then in February, the Parkland shooting happened. 6 weeks and about $12,000 later, the elementary building got its own new vestibule.
That's one of the most important things that we've done as a result of Parkland, is we have totally secured all of the entrances to our four buildings.
And Addis says that's just the start. He says the school board's also considering buying devices that would allow staff to barricade doors inside the building, too. But with all the classrooms, offices, and other spaces, there are about 250 doors district-wide, and securing them all could cost almost $30,000.
So school districts have to work to see, are these devices actually ones that will work? Are we running into any companies that simply are taking advantage of a time to make some money?
He says he gets a couple emails a week from companies selling this gadget or that service, all promising to make his school safer. Robin Hattersley is executive editor at Campus Safety Magazine, a trade publication for security professionals. She says every time there's a high-profile shooting, there tends to be a spike in sales for a lot of different products.
Things like video surveillance, access control, locks, metal detection, two-way radios, emergency notification, call boxes, panic buttons, fences.
According to the research firm IHS Market, these products and the services that go with them add up to a $2.7 billion school security industry, one they project to grow by 1% a year for the next few years. One person adding to that growth is J.R. Supas, who sells school safety equipment from his office in North Canton, Ohio. Inside, he holds up an orange-colored steel spike, about 4 inches long.
This here is Bolo stick.
In an emergency, you can jam it in the door to barricade it from intruders. Cost, $59.
Puts it in the hole. So about 4,500 pounds of pressure can be put against that, and it's not going to break.
Supas is a former school administrator. Today, he heads up an educational consulting company called DriveMind Group, which does over half its business selling safety products to schools. Things like a $3,000 visitor ID system and an app that lets school staff monitor social media and receive anonymous tips. Supas has been in business about a year, and he says in that time, he's never really had to give the hard sell.
Instead of having to go find customers, we were getting people coming to us.
One reason is that Ohio is no stranger to school shootings. In fact, there have been 5 school shootings in the state since 2012. But schools also have limited budgets. So even if parents and administrators want to see increased security, school districts might not have the money.
Financially, we're strapped right now.
That's Norton School Superintendent Dana Addis again. He says he's weighing whether to buy more security equipment or spend the money on personnel instead, like full-time resource officers or mental health counselors. He says each of those positions would add another dimension of safety to his school. But of course, their salaries would cost money too. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
In the show, we talked about New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's resignation after allegations of physical violence were reported in The New Yorker. Now, to be clear, Schneiderman was accused of abuse, not workplace harassment. But in the Me Too era, many institutions are rethinking their harassment policies and how they train people. And now that includes business schools. Katie Johnston wrote about this trend for the Boston Globe. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What are business schools doing to address sexual harassment? Can you just sort of give me a sense of how they've changed their curricula?
Well, a lot of them are doing workshops, some of them just doing one-off classes, conversations about sexual harassment. The Sloan School at MIT is launching a class next spring that is going to look at inclusion and equity and include sexual harassment as part of that. Carnegie Mellon is working on developing a virtual reality training about sexual harassment. And one thing they're doing at Northeastern, which is really interesting, is they're overhauling the whole curriculum at the business school there. And in part, they want to weave issues facing working women into the fabric of the coursework.
Do you think that this is something that we would see in curricula for various business programs if it were not for Me Too and the, you know, sort of high profile sexual harassment cases we've seen over the past year?
I think it's definitely a response to Me Too. I mean, business schools have started tailoring more things to women as more women have enrolled in business schools and getting their MBAs. I mean, by 2030, I think they're projecting that half of MBA students will be women, and that's up from, you know, 30% not that long ago. So I think that that is kind of growing out of that. Also, in the last couple of years, there's been more of an emphasis on ethics and values and not just finance and accounting. So I think it also plays into that trend as well, that realizing that the workplace is a lot more than just numbers and dollars.
Yeah, when we think of business school, I mean, certainly one of the knocks against it in the past has been kind of a bro-y culture and a focus on finance, not on thinking about ethics and workplace leadership. Did you get a sense from the students that you talked to that they want, you know, a broader curriculum and a curriculum that thinks about, you know, things beyond numbers?
Definitely. They definitely see the need to expand it. At the Sloan School at MIT in December, the students put on a series of workshops on their own. You know, they brought in some improv actors, and some of the students I talked to, men and women, were saying they felt a real responsibility to address this as, you know, these future leaders coming from these high power business schools, to stop the culture of sexual harassment, which has become so ingrained in corporate America.
I'm wondering where you see this kind of training working into a business school curriculum and whether it's something that's in there for the long haul.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, sometimes, you know, the next hot new trend might come along and they might drop it, but it does seem to be a huge part of workplace culture. And I think business schools realize they are training the next generation of executives and business leaders, and they have a real opportunity to change the culture.
Katie Johnston is a business reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been bringing you a lot of big stories today, but there's more to our economy than just what grabs the headlines. So we like to dig a little deeper into what shapes our day-to-day lives. That's the thesis behind our series, My Economy. And for our latest installment, we go to Lynchburg, Virginia.
My name is Matt Shule, and I'm a store manager at Shule Furniture Company in Lynchburg, Virginia. It's our family business. We've been in business for 120 years. Before I became a store manager, I was a journalist in Washington, D.C. for 8 years. The moment that I told my dad that I was going to work for the family business, and he was very, I think, surprised. I had never really shown an interest before. I remember my first day on the job, my boss at the time, he said, "Today you're going to put together this computer desk." Which took like 3 hours to try to figure out how it, you know, went together. And then I remember coming home and telling my wife, and she was like, "Wow, that's a lot different than before when you were going to Capitol Hill and interviewing senators and congressmen and traveling around the world." It was definitely a learning curve. I mean, now I'm obviously not doing furniture assembly, but it's still a challenge, and it's still a lot different than what I used to do. When you get married and have a family, and you start to think about your priorities, like, it started to make a lot more sense. You know, I think that that small town becomes a lot more attractive, because after you live in the big city, you start to realize how expensive things are. And if you don't have the right job, or if you don't have some sort of other wealth, then it can be really hard to achieve that same cost of living that you were brought up with. We definitely feel a lot more comfortable here. You know, we like it a lot.
This series only works because of you. We love to hear how you're getting by. So send us your story. Just go to marketplace.org. this final note before we go today. Everything, and I do mean everything, has a bottom line, including the, oh, hey, go see my new movie social media post. Sure, we're used to celebrities hawking products or posting about free designer clothes, but get this. Dwayne Johnson, also known as The Rock, of course, will get $1 million social media fee as part of his $22 million salary package for the movie Red Notice. That's according to Variety. I mean, the guy has 104 million Instagram followers, so that actually seems like a pretty decent deal. All right, it's time to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained a tiny fraction, 2 points. The NASDAQ gained less than 0.1%, 1 point, and the S&P 500 shed a fraction. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Moody is the executive director of digital. Zatara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you all again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.